on shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is Media Network Plus.
Well, hello everyone, I'm Keith Powell, and it's very nice to have you with us for another edition of the program. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking about fixers, the people behind foreign correspondents. But first, All India Radio. Now, All India Radio is a huge organization. They cover all of India. They also have a very large external service, or as it's also called, the External Services Division. Now, it was just recently discussed on various radio and shortwave blogs that All India Radio might be leaving shortwave. Now, the external service of All India Radio is, let's say, not as big as the Voice of America or BBC World Service or China Radio International, but they do broadcast 57 transmissions a day, 72 hours of programming covering 108 countries in 27 languages. The Indian languages are Bengali, Gujarati, Hindi, Kannada, Malayalam, Nepali, Punjabi, Saraiki, Sindhi, Tamil, Telugu, Urdu. The foreign languages include Arabic, Balochi, Burmese, Chinese, Dari, French, Indonesian, Persian, Pashto, Russian, Sinhala, Swahili, Thai, Tibetan, and the General Overseas Service in English. Now, a lot of people are wondering why. Well, you have to look at All India Radio International's service, or the ESD, the External Services Division. Now, most international broadcasters do spend a lot of money on just transmission. At Radio Netherlands, when Radio Netherlands was around, it was between 40 and 45% of its budget, back when they had 32 million euros, that is, went towards transmission. The same with Radio Canada International, Deutsche Welle, Radio France International, and others. So that's actually rather high. But compared to the external service of All India Radio, well, that's a different ball game. They're spending up to 95%, yes, 95% of its budget on its external division. That has to do with maintaining its shortwave transmitters, which include the high cost of spares on for transmitters that are no longer being made. Very often, parts have to be sourced or even built to keep the transmitters on the air. Now, All India Radio uses everything from 50 to even 500 kilowatts. So it's also very expensive. But we have to look at the content of All India Radio. Now, most international broadcasters either begin on the hour or, in some rare cases, on the half hour, like Radio Netherlands used to do many, many years ago when they were a radio station. All India Radio has, if we just take English as an example, the General Overseas Service. Sometimes they begin at 5 minutes after the hour, 10 minutes after the hour, 15 minutes after the hour, 25 minutes to the hour, 15 minutes to the hour, and 10 minutes to the hour. Some programs on the General Overseas English Service are 10 minutes long, yes, a 10-minute transmission. Some are 20 minutes, some are 1 hour, some are 30 minutes, and some are 1 hour and 45 minutes, and some are 1 hour and 30 minutes. So it really is all over the place. The other thing that I personally would have to criticize the external services of All India Radio for is a lack of continuity when it comes to programming. Now, this is something, of course, that I've heard from other people before as well, because if you do tune into All India Radio, you really never know what to expect. Now, they do play, of course, a lot of music during their transmissions, but you kind of have to wonder if they're just playing the music to fill in the airtime, which it seems like it is. In many ways, All India Radio today in 2016 doesn't sound too different than it did as it did in the late 1940s. It's almost like a station that, you know, came around in the 1940s, and over the decades, just didn't change at all. Now, the other thing about All India Radio that really sets it apart from all the other international broadcasters, as we know, in the developing world, it is very difficult sometimes for broadcasters to have the money to get new equipment. And sometimes the broadcasts don't exactly sound, you can say, professional. But all the broadcasts from All India Radio's external service today actually sound worse than developing stations 30 years ago. If you listen to old air checks of Radio Peking, today known as China Radio International, Radio Peking sounded better. The Voice of Korea from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, also sounds better. When you tune to All India Radio, it's almost as if one day it sounds this way, the next day it sounds another way. There are times where the announcer sounds as if they're speaking from a tin can and not using a microphone. About 5 years ago, or perhaps 6 years ago, Radio Netherlands and All India Radio, General Overseas Service, joined forces, and some programs from Radio Netherlands, for example, Earthbeat, a program that I used to freelance for, would have a version produced in India by All India Radio. Well, the two versions of the show couldn't have sounded any different. The one from Radio Netherlands sounded clean, crisp, and had excellent audio. The one from All India Radio sounded amateurish, poorly put together, and sounded like they were speaking from the inside of a very bad echo chamber. Well, let's say that relationship didn't last too long. Now, this is how All India Radio sounds on shortwave.
Union Finance Minister Arun Jaitley has called upon states to reform to become best investment destinations. Addressing the domestic and global investors meet in Gurgaon yesterday, Mr. Jaitley said the future would be competitive federalism. Mr. Jaitley said this is the right time for economic reforms to attract investment. Mr. Jaitley said amid global economic slowdown, India is able to maintain a respectable growth rate. He said the investors across the globe are looking at India because of its higher economic growth, larger market, and wider base of human resource. Urban Development Minister Venkaiah Naidu, Railway Minister...
Now that was actually one of the better sounding transmissions from All India Radio. Now All India Radio has also been in the news concerning DRM, or Digital Radio Mondiale. In fact, the DRM consortium was so excited about the fact that All India Radio was making the conversion over to DRM for its transmissions. Well, this actually sort of leaves all that in limbo. Now, DRM in India is going to be problematic at best. A few months ago, we did a review of an Indian-made DRM receiver called the Avion. And as I said, it was just absolutely horrible, like most DRM receivers that have appeared on the market. Also, the price. It's out of the price range for most average Indians. Now, for some time now, All India Radio, external service, has been using DRM for its transmissions. Now, anybody who's familiar with DRM will know how good it actually sounds when it's engineered right. Here's an example of Radio New Zealand International on DRM.
The Australian think tank, the Lowy Institute, says women in the Pacific, particularly in Papua New Guinea, continue to face extreme challenges. The Institute has just held a panel discussion to highlight the big challenges for women in the region, such as domestic violence and poor access to political representation. A 2013 study by Medicine Sans Frontiers found 70% of PNG women will be raped or assaulted in their lifetime. The Institute.
That, of course, is Radio New Zealand International on DRM broadcasting to the Pacific. Now, Radio New Zealand International uses DRM to reach its FM transmitters. It, of course, is a lot cheaper than using satellite, and because of the poor quality of internet services in the Pacific, it is actually the best option. If you've ever tuned to All India Radio DRM, you would be surprised.
If agitation becomes violent, it would affect India also, as people on both sides have deep-rooted social, cultural and religious ties. Besides, the Indian transport and trading companies are suffering huge financial losses as their goods carriers laden with petroleum products and other essential commodities meant for Nepal are stranded at border points for a long time. Nepal government is also put to tremendous loss of revenue by way of custom duties, which is its main source of earning. Trade and industry in Nepal have come to a standstill, and private sector is forced to bear losses worth billions of rupees and country's economy has suffered a death blow.
Yes, that was All India Radio's external service on DRM. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty sure that I can find telephone quality audio and even medium wave quality audio that sounds better. Now, as I mentioned, All India Radio has been using DRM for quite some time on a number of its transmissions, and they all sound like that. So, it leaves the question of what is going to happen next. Well, we still don't know, and it seems they are discussing whether or not to shut it down. They want to move over to internet services. Now, you would think that even internet audio would sound even better. Well, sadly, it doesn't. Sadly, even audio from All India Radio that is streamed sounds just as poor as what we just heard, and in some cases, even poorer. Now, All India Radio is one of those stations that for decades has just been going along and going through the motions. A lot of people even wonder how many listeners they have. Well, of all international broadcasters, they're probably also down at the bottom of the scale, like Radio Belarus that recently shut down, or even Radio Cairo. So what is the future? Well, sadly, I would predict that in the next year, or even less, or maybe just a little bit more, the external service of All India Radio, the ESD External Services Division, will discontinue to broadcast on shortwave and will only continue online. Also, what does this hold for the future of DRM, Digital Radio Mondial, or as it's also nicknamed by myself and a number of other people in the media, doesn't really matter? Well, the future doesn't seem too bright, especially if the audio on DRM is going to sound like this. That is a big issue. Second, of course, big issue is that Avion receiver, which we tested and we did a review of, and I should mention, by the way, that radio just automatically just stopped working, is so bad that I don't know how somebody is going to spend over $100 for that radio. India is changing rapidly when it comes to communications. Mobile services are improving greatly. In fact, in many parts of India now, where radio service is limited, mobile service will cover the whole area. And a lot of young Indians, say under 40, are now starting to receive content through mobile phones and mobile services. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Glory 105, which is PDF 222 journal.
Speed 220, Glory 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Well, in the past, having worked as a foreign correspondent, you may think that it's easy, that you just, you know, live wherever you're living and you cover news stories. Well, actually, no, it isn't really that easy, especially if it's in a country where you don't know the history, the culture, or even the language or the political system. So very often, foreign correspondents will go overseas, and before they do, we'll contact a fixer. Now, this is somebody who does some of the groundwork for the foreign correspondent. For example, cutting through red tape and being able to make sure that you can get the interviews that you want. Colin Merrill, she's a senior lecturer at the Deakin University in Victoria, Australia. She wrote a book called Foreign Correspondence and International News Gathering, The Role of Fixers. She speaks next to Richard Ady.
A local fixer is absolutely your eyes and ears on the ground. If you have to turn up somewhere at the last moment, then you hire a fixer, preferably in advance, if you've got good contacts or when you arrive. They'll get you people to interview. They've got good contacts, and that's where the editorial side comes in. They've very well connected. If they've worked as a fixer before, then they know the kinds of things you're after. They know what makes a good television story or a good print story. It's a whole range of things, you know, basically that ranges right from logistical through to, you know, getting scoops for reporters, which happens often. People don't always admit it, but it definitely happens. And the people that I interviewed did go on to explain how they helped to get them all kinds of scoops and exclusives.
Yeah. You interviewed a number of foreign correspondents, including some Australians like Britt McLeod and Zoe Daniel and Hugh Merrimonton and Matt Brown. What did they tell you that they were looking for in a fixer?
Look, very often it depended on the story. Some of the reporters on the commercial side very often thought that all they needed really was a fixer come taxi driver. And providing that's the kind of story you're after, big demonstrations, trouble, etc., then that's the kind of role people are going to give you. But if you're after really difficult, complicated political stories, then you're more likely to try and find an academic to work with or a local journalist. Local journalists were absolutely the best people that reporters wanted, just because they understand exactly what you're doing and how you're going about it and the kinds of things that make news stories.
It's interesting that the preference for other journalists, for local journalists, because although when you explain it, it makes sense. They want the understanding, especially of the demands and constraints of the television news. They want, you know, the contacts and those things. But there's another way of looking at it, isn't it? And that is that journalists want people like themselves a bit, but a bit different.
Well, this was one of the things that I came across through my examination of this area, because I hadn't really thought about it that carefully beforehand, which is that people are actually seeking out what I termed people like us. You're hunting for people who will find you the same kinds of exciting, interesting stories that we all want to investigate as journalists. And so those people are naturally going to be globalized citizens who speak good English, who've probably traveled. They have the same kinds of, you know, attitudes as you do, really. You're not going to employ somebody who's got extreme views unless you need to, just for a specific job.
There's an example in the book of Chris Clark, ABC foreign correspondent. He hired a former professor of English literature at Grosny University, not someone you'd immediately think would be a fixer.
Chris Clark, when I interviewed him, was discussing and analysing, I think possibly for Foreign Correspondent, you know, the difficult issues, political and economic issues of Chechnya at the time. And therefore, he was looking for somebody who could really explain the different layers.
Actually, the other thing I'm remembering about that particular interview was that although he had these, you know, relatively sophisticated analytical skills, he also made sure that he brought a rifle with him when they went up to the mountains.
Well, sorting out danger is a big part of being a fixer, no matter where you go. And Hugh Remington also talked about that quite a lot, that hiring a fixer really helped you to feel safer in terms of understanding who the different groups are in different places, sometimes just by knowing which clothes different people wear, different tribes, different people, and knowing whether you've strayed into the wrong area, etc.
Yeah, he calls that cultural interpretation. And there's something in that, isn't there?
There is. The most interesting place for me, which I honed in on, was obviously at the time it was Iraq, basically because correspondents could no longer go there out into the streets very easily. So I honed in really on the BBC and CNN, who were two operations that were keeping people round the clock in Iraq on sort of 6-week rotations, and looked at what that meant when the journalists can't get out into the streets very much, and therefore more editorial importance was being given to the fixer.
The situation in Iraq, and it was a particularly difficult one, does highlight a couple of issues with fixers, which is that if you can't vet them in some way, or you don't have a very, very good personal recommendation, you don't know if a fixer might hold a perspective that you're not aware of that can completely shape your output.
Absolutely. And what I loved about journalists is they're not always the most self-reflexive people. I'd count myself in there as well. You know, they think that they can work out someone's political beliefs and where they're coming from very easily and deal with that, factor it in. But when I interviewed the Fixers, it became quite obvious that actually the Fixers did change things, or they knew of people who'd change things when it mattered to them. For example, in Iraq, you know, one of the Fixers that I interviewed said, well, if we thought it was too dangerous to go to a certain place, we would say the road was closed. If we didn't like the perspective sometimes of one of the people that they wanted to interview, we would say, oh, that person's away at the moment, we can't get there. So journalists are, they're not always aware of exactly what's going on, especially if they don't speak the language and deals were being cut behind their backs that perhaps they didn't know about.
Yes. Similarly, and this is actually, in a way, it's sort of more fundamental from the Fixer's point of view, you can't be sure if a Fixer's under pressure from a local who's got authority or real power.
Yeah, the Fixer I interviewed from Gaza said that quite a bit, that actually he came under more pressure locally from people saying to him, why does he report the story like this? Why isn't he telling the story how we would like him to? Tell him to come and interview my family. You know, there's quite a lot of pressure goes on that way as well.
Well, I want to ask you about a couple of, I suppose, stories that you highlight in which the Fixers made a huge difference. I love this one. There's a story of the ITN correspondent Bill Neely getting off the plane in Buenos Aires in about 1995 and meeting, well, he described her as Mrs. Doubtfire, but she turned out to be very capable.
Yes, he said that he was very disappointed when he got to the airport and he saw this woman that reminded him of Mrs. Doubtfire, and he thought, oh, goodness, this is going to be no good at all. And he had this story that he had to get. It was Princess Diana's time and she was about to go to Argentina. And so ITN asked him to get an interview with President Menem. So he worked on that with this woman. She seemed to be quite well connected, etc. And within 24 hours, she had that story for him. And she also said, look, I've got an exclusive for you if you're interested. They're shipping out a Nazi war criminal through the airport tomorrow and I can get you an interview with him. And he did that too. He did this great story that nobody else had. And afterwards, he said to her, well, how did you get that for me? And she said, well, you know, I'm related to President Menem, so that was quite easy. And I'm a Nazi war hunter.
Right, as you do. She was an example of someone being prearranged. So he didn't know her. It wasn't a recommendation. He got off the plane and ITN had basically lined her up.
Yes, because ITN, certainly when I worked there, and I'm sure they still do today, have firm databases for Fixers. And people who go out on trips are meant to update them all the time. What people used to do was after a trip, they would write up how it had worked and they might put in this person very good with a political story, not so good when I asked them to do this. Perhaps their political views are a little bit, off center for us, or, you know, like that. People just put all kinds of information in there, which enabled you to make studied guesses, I suppose, about who was the best person that you might want. And those databases were the same for the BBC. Obviously, though, quite a few correspondents I spoke to did talk about not passing the names on of really good Fixers.
Yes, so you'll share the okay ones, but the really good ones you try and keep to yourself.
Yeah.
The other thing I wondered about the whole time while going through the book was what this was all saying about international news. Because, as I already mentioned, news providers are doing less of it because of the expense. And that changes the nature of the foreign correspondent. There are fewer people who basically live in a city and get to know it well. How does that change the nature of the Fixer?
Well, I think there's a lot of changes going on in international news gathering at the moment. There are some extremely successful Fixers who will end up with reporting jobs because lots of organisations, including the BBC, are moving towards employing more local people. But for others, if there's more parachute journalism, people landing at the last minute, you know, that makes their life more difficult, but that's probably going to happen more as well, because more people, there are fewer staff correspondents, but there are probably more people travelling than ever before.
Colleen Merrill, the author of Foreign Correspondents and International News Gathering, The Role of Fixers. She's also a senior lecturer of journalism at Deakin University in Victoria, Australia, and she was speaking there with Richard Ady. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. And we now turn our attention to propagation and what has been happening and what we can expect over the next 7 days. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through April 23rd. Normal to fair at low and middle latitudes, fair to poor at high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through April 23rd, magnetic conditions quiet until unsettled on the 23rd, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, solar activity low or very low through April 24th. Late on April 23rd or early on the 24th, a coronal hole high-speed stream is likely to bring some active geomagnetic spells. From Peter Kohlmann in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet on April 22nd, May 6th and 7th. Quiet to active April 23rd, 24th, 29th, 30th, May 4th, 5th, 9th and 10th. Quiet to unsettled April 25th, 26th and May 11th. Mostly quiet on April 27th, 28th, May 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 8th. Active to disturbed on May 9th and 10th. Space Weather Canada calls for the most magnetic activity in the auroral zone to occur on May 10th. From SWPC in Boulder, unsettled conditions expected April 23rd to 26th, with isolated active periods likely due to a second recurrent positive polarity coronal hole high-speed stream. Mostly quiet conditions April 27th and 28th. Unsettled to active April 29th and 30th, with minor storm periods likely on the 29th, with A and K indices peaking at 20 and 5. A greater peak of 25 and 5 on May 10th. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 or 8 and 3 on April 27th, 28th, May 1st to 3rd, and 5th to 8th. Lowest solar flux, mostly 95, from April 24th to May 2nd, peaking at only 100 on May 3rd to 5th, unless we get another surprise sunspot like last week. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps call for extreme tropospheric ducting all week along the west coast of Mexico and along the Tamaulipas, Texas coast starting April 26th. Ducting is building up in the central and eastern Mediterranean, but not yet extreme. It is extreme in the Red Sea and all around the Arabian coast to Pakistan and India, also from the east coast of India to Bangladesh and Myanmar, along the coasts of Angola and Namibia until April 25th, between Mozambique and Madagascar April 23rd, and along the west coast of Australia April 23rd and 24th.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of the program. If you wish to contact us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. And do let us know how you heard the program, either shortwave, medium wave, FM, DAB, satellite, or online. We'd love to know. And also, if you heard it through one of our partner stations, let us know what partner station it is. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you well. 73 and 88 to the ladies.